Races on, and with the FIA's process of analysing the way the late safety car period was handled in the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix underway, and continued question marks over Lewis Hamilton's future, the controversial end to the 2021 season remains the big talking point in 2022. But what can we expect to change? And is Hamilton retiring really a possibility? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to answer those questions and more are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Well, Scott, hello. How's life? You now completely clear of COVID?
Yep, all good. The recovery is well and truly underway. I've discovered in the last few days that my the combination of having COVID and then before that I had a bit of a chest infection, like having that back-to-back attack on my respiratory system has left me like my cardio levels are absolutely zero at the moment. So I'm out of breath so crazy easily. But other than that, all good. Looking forward to, well, I was going to say speaking about this topic for the 100th time in the last sort of 3 weeks, but at least we have some new stuff to get into today. So it doesn't feel like we're treading over quite as much old ground as before.
Yep, it has certainly now moved on. And Mark Hughes, how are you? You're down south this time.
Yes, I'm southwest. I'm from the northeast. So I'd like to just do the opposite and just see what it's like outside. I'm fine. I'm COVID-free. Assuming I could make a visa application correctly, I could be eligible for the Australian Open because I've got no COVID and I'm fully vaccinated. But other than that, everything's good.
Excellent. And a good topical joke in there as well, which we like to see. Although I do have to say, if you're going to do the opposite of the northwest, wouldn't you have to be in the southeast? Kent or somewhere like that.
That's my ends.
No, I'm from the northeast. I live in the northwest. The opposite of the northeast is the southwest.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Yeah, okay.
You've spoiled it now. You've spoiled it. Doesn't matter. Just cut it out.
Someone needs to explain to Ed how mirrors work.
They're just magic, aren't they? I'm like a dog when I look in a mirror. I was like, who's that? Totally baffling. Anyway, well, it's good for me to ruin things early on in a podcast rather than wait until a bit later. But let's crack into it, Scott. The FIA last month promised this process of analysing Abu Dhabi would happen. Now it's finally offered a little bit more detail about what that process might be. So what exactly is the scope of this and what changes have been hinted at already?
Yeah, it's good to it's good that the FIA has finally broken its silence because this is a really important process for Formula One. And it was becoming problematic that we still didn't have any details about it. I understand that this all kicked off just before Christmas. You have the Christmas break, the New Year as well. However important this is, I think realistically, it was unreasonable to expect that there would be a huge amount of progress over that sort of week, 2 week period. But we are, you know, getting into mid-January and it was starting to feel like, well, it's been a month now, so are we going to hear anything? Well, we have now. The governing body has broken its silence. The process has started. New President Mohammed bin Sulayem has kicked off a consultation with all teams on various issues, including the Abu Dhabi review. And we've got a little bit more meat on the bones as to how that process will play out. In addition to talking to the key parties, which is going to include people like race director Michael Massey and the stewards, there's going to be a specific point of discussion on the agenda of an FIA meeting on, I think it's January the 19th. I'm blanking on the exact name of it, but is it the Sporting Advisory Committee? I think it's officially called, but it's basically that body that discusses potential rule changes and then proposes potential rule changes to the F1 Commission and the World Motorsport Council to then ratify it. So that's going to be specifically on the use of the safety car. Once we get past this point, there's going to be a shared discussion involving the drivers, and then it'll all be finally presented, all the findings of the report, to the F1 Commission in February. So with final sign-off from the WMSC in March, but we'll know before, because I think the WMSC meeting's like the Friday of the Bahrain Grand Prix, which obviously way too late to do anything. But so we'll know before then. I don't think you take that as the date for which the actual decisions and changes will be made and known. I think it will come a bit sooner than that. So that's sort of broadly the process. As for what's going to change, well, it's quite a broad topic because we don't have specifics on exactly what it is the FIA wants to learn. But I think it's just important to understand that The specific areas that might change are certain elements of the regulations, which we can get into in a bit more detail in a bit. Things like how the safety car is used, how to ensure a green flag finish, stopping team bosses coming over the radio. But then there's also the big question of what's Massey's future. And also, as has emerged in the last few days, whether or not Nicholas Tombassis, who is the most senior technical person, I guess, within the FIA technical department, what happens to him? Because he seems to have been roped into this with Mercedes putting pressure on the FIA, etc. So I think there's potential for quite a bit to change. It's just good to get the process started so we can have a bit more transparency.
Yeah, it's a lot better than the FIA leaving things hanging, because when they announced the fact there would be an analysis, they also declared it was a misunderstanding from the wider world that had tarnished the image of F1, which was a bit of a stupid thing to put out publicly, because it did imply that, well, we were fine, but everyone failed to understand it. So I think at least the FIA is a little bit too late, realised that all they needed to do was just say, right, this process now is happening, this is the timeline, here's roughly who's involved, and here's broadly the scope of it. And then they can be allowed to work through it. But it is interesting how broad it is, because obviously the focus is on the last five or so laps in Abu Dhabi, the letting the lap cars past or not, letting five of the eight lap cars past, the question of the timing of the safety car coming in. So that's the focus of it. But it is broader than that. Obviously, there have been problems or concerns among drivers with the way race control had dealt with things over quite a long period of time, actually. Certainly back into 2020, there were issues with that. Think about use of the safety car in Mugello, the way it was used there was being talked about. That's a slightly different use of the safety car, but it all comes under the same umbrella. And the fact you referenced there, this suggestion that perhaps Mercedes is pushing for Nicholas Tombassis to be replaced, that shows, I think, where Mercedes are at in their mindset. They see what happened in Abu Dhabi as part of a wider thing as well. Not only is it a question of good governance and good running of Formula One, it's also a question of the fact they felt quite targeted by some of these sort of random decisions and processes. Obviously, they kind of blamed Tombassis for the rule changes that were done ostensibly to protect the tyres that they felt hurt the low rate car. So there's a lot of threads feeding into this, although we should stress that what this process is not is anything about reviewing the result in Abu Dhabi. We have to stress that that ship has long since sailed. Mercedes withdrew the process. That will not change. It was never going to change. And actually, this is about far more than the outcome of the 2021 World Championship. It's about the way F1 runs itself.
It's interesting because we've had the first real hint of what they're going to do or what they could do on the FIA organisational side, which includes, I would assume, the futures of Massey and Tombassis, because Ben Sulayem has asked Peter Beyer, who is the Secretary General for Sport, I think, for the FIA, and he's also head of the single-seater pillars, effectively. That was a change that's been implemented for 2022. So he's been empowered to propose ways to review and optimise the organisation of the FIA F1 structure. And I can't read that without interpreting that to mean potential changes on in terms of personnel. What is the FIA F1 structure if not the race director and, you know, the previous head of technical matters for single seaters? But it's interesting because it's a good opportunity actually for the FIA to really commit to a clean slate. And Mark might be best placed to explain this, but there's already been a little bit of changing behind the scenes before the Abu Dhabi controversy. There was talk about bringing all of the F1 technical matters into the remit of the F1, which is where this sort of restructure with Peter Beyer being in charge of everything overall came in. So there does seem to be potential here for the FIA to really get a proper reshuffle and refresh in the pipeline. Do you see any potential connection there, Mark, or are they sort of slightly disconnected?
Yeah, I think they're disconnected. It just happened at the same time. The restructure happened, it became clear to us on the morning of Abu Dhabi, actually. So it's unconnected to what happened in the final laps of that race. So yes, Peter Byers will be in charge, and the respective chiefs of technical, sporting and commercial will all report to him. And the F1, the form technical group, the group that came up with the new concept of cars, the Pat Simmons overseen group. That's now been, now that these the formula's in place, that is, and then Pat's retiring later in the year, in the summer, I believe. That group has now been moved within the FIA and it will report to Peter Byers. So I don't think there's any, just the fact that he is the one that's been made responsible for this review, I don't think it necessarily says that he's, you know, the Massey won't be there or Tom Bassas won't be there. They may not be, but I think that's unconnected with Peter Byers' position there. But yes, I think, as Ed said, the important thing to stress to the listeners is this is not going to change the outcome. That's just not happening. But there may be some regulation change or some personnel change, and there may be some agreement has been made behind the closed doors, because I think everybody's accepted that the outcome couldn't change even if the regulations were incorrectly applied. But there may have been a compromise agreed to of some form, and we'll get to hear about it then. But there's definitely a political element, because there's what's being done and there's what's being seen to be done. So the FIA have to be seen to be doing something, because it was such a controversial ending, and then the FIA's systems were called into question, and the legitimacy of the outcome was called into question. So something has to be done when something like that happens. So at least that is happening. But there's also the political element in the effective standoff between. There's been a link made between Lewis not commenting whether he's going to continue next year, and what the changes might be. So effectively, it's being read as a standoff, you know, whereby Lewis might or might not, depending on what the outcome of this is. But I think the FIA, the way that it is presented, what it's going to do, and the timing of it, whereby it's saying that this will be announced on the first day of practice of the first race of the season, it's effectively disentangling itself from anything like that, because it's saying, well, Lewis can do what he wants, that's up to him, but he's going to have to decide before we announce anything, because the practice will have started for the first race. So it's effectively got them out of that, publicly at least. It's decoupling their actions from whatever Lewis decides, so it can't be seen as being influenced by, you know, or held a ransom by Lewis.
It's been interpreted the other way by some people on, I saw some people on social media suggesting that this was actually the FIA trying to force Lewis's hand by having that late announcement, because it basically says, well, you know, you can play chicken all you like, but you're not going to know until then. But I do genuinely believe that Mercedes and Hamilton, even if we don't know officially and the public don't know, I think Mercedes and Hamilton will know everything they need to know by the time this is presented to at the end of the F1 commission in February. I think they'll know what they need to know. But I agree with you, it's a good way for the FIA probably to just sort of make it be like, well, this is, we're laying out very clearly when this is all going to happen. Anything else that happens around this, do what you like.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by there's what's happening and there's what's been seen to be happening.
And that's why it is good that the FIA is actually committed to a few things on the timelines. These processes do take some time and should be done properly, so nobody has any problem with that. And we should stress that Mercedes has said, Toto Wolff said this, that they will hold the FIA accountable in making sure they follow this process correctly. So that's what Mercedes' involvement is in this. But it's an interesting question as to what the list of things that need to change are, because there's a lot of focus on the personnel. You've got to say probably Michael Massey's position is untenable given what happened. There were, subject to some other agreements and things coming out, that there, because there was this desire to make sure that races finish under green flag conditions. It does seem that Massey's position is untenable because the rules weren't followed as they were written. You can just about argue the lap cars one, but the one about the timing of the safety car coming in is unequivocal. And I don't feel the steward's explanation for why that was fine held water. I just think it was plainly incorrect. That's an area of the regs that will be tidied up. So there are multiple strands to be tackled here, and I think it would be naive for anyone to think the problem would be solved by, say, Michael Massey being removed, because he's not the sole aspect of the problem, because it's all about the sport versus entertainment stuff. And there is a scenario where Michael Massey carries on, because obviously he's not an incompetent, he's not an idiot. He does have a decent amount of experience, and he is being steered in terms of what he's trying to do by the way the FIA, the way F1 as a whole wants to do it. So that's why it needs to be a proper three-dimensional thing, not just, oh, it's your fault, out you go, do a kind of 1980s Ferrari-style blame one person.
Well, my concern with it is what confidence we can have in the FIA to actually go as far as admitting fault where there was actually fault. My concern is that we're going to have a compromise where, and it, as a compromise, it doesn't mean that there won't be anything good that comes from it, but I suspect there'll be a compromise where they find a way to stick with and validate what happened in Abu Dhabi. They'll stand by Massi and the stewards by sticking to this interpretation of Article 15.3, I think, in the sporting regulations, which gives the race director overriding authority on many issues, including the use of the safety car, which is basically the justification for him doing what he wants with the end of the safety car period, for lack of a better phrase. I think what they'll do is they'll say that the rules allowed this to happen, but we recognise that it's clearly caused a problem. Again, they said before that we've all just misunderstood this, so therefore we're going to tighten up a few rules, change a few rules to make sure this can't happen again. And that way what they'll do is they won't have to admit they actually did anything wrong, but they'll basically find a way to say, but we could do this better in the future. I don't think that is a full and thorough and transparent investigation, really, because I think what you really need to be getting into is just point blank, was this handled incorrectly or not? But I just feel like it's a bit naive and unrealistic to actually expect the FIA to do this, because organisations that investigate themselves just tend to close ranks a little bit, don't you? Do you two have complete confidence that the FIA would be able to look at this and say, yes, we definitely got that wrong, and then publicly admit that?
No, it's a damage limitation exercise. It's already gone wrong. And to actually go through it and say, yeah, this was actually wrong. It was the wrong call by the race director and the wrong call by the stewards on appeal afterwards. Would therefore, the next question is, so the result is invalid then. You're then getting into disastrous PR for, you know, you can't change the outcome of the world championship. That's just, it's done. It went wrong, and it went wrong in the way it did, and it's now done. So they can only do a damage limitation. And yeah, I would expect to be very much like what you've just outlined, Scott. It would be, it was actually technically correct under the rules that were in place at the time, but we recognise that it wasn't very satisfactory, so we're going to change these rules.
It comes down to a question of being pragmatic in expectations, and Mercedes will be as well. Ultimately, whatever happens, an admission that they implemented it incorrectly wouldn't really change anything or have a huge effect. The number one thing that needs to happen is they ensure that the regs are correct, that the application of the regs is consistent and correct, that any kind of tension between administering Formula One races correctly and the pressure to ensure that there's a good show, that tension needs to be solved and the balance struck correctly. Now, yes, other things fine, but the really key thing is, and this was clear from the moment the whole situation arose, is that for the long term, the problem is tackled. And I'm sure Mercedes will be pragmatic about it. What I think Mercedes mean when Toto Wolff says they want to hold the FIA to account is they want to make sure that there are changes. Toto Wolff's got a big thing. He's spoken about it before, about governance and good practice. He talks about in the business world, obviously he's might be called generically a businessman by trade, if you like, before he got involved in running racing teams. And he talks about there are very clear governance structures in place for the way businesses act and the way things are dealt with. And he feels that it has been too fast and loose in Formula One. He said this long before what happened in Abu Dhabi, but obviously Abu Dhabi has hyped up the whole thing in the mind. So I'm sure that Wolff and Mercedes, their mindset is, we want to see a good situation for the longer term. So I think that's the key thing. Does anyone have any specifics in mind of what they want to see in terms of changes, particularly in terms of the way the regulations are framed?
I think we need to have specifically. There was no ambiguity about that particular regulation of lap cars before. It was either all the lap cars or none of the lap cars. There was ambiguity.
To be precise on it, it did say any lapped cars. Now, that's clearly intended to mean all of them, but it doesn't necessarily. But
just means if you are allowing lap cars through.
It's an ambiguous one, isn't it?
It means that once the process of lap cars unlapping themselves has gone through, if you are going to do that, and you might not necessarily be doing that, then this happens.
The timing of the safety car coming in, absolutely, that's 100%.
Yeah.
That it comes in the end of the lap after the lap cars go through. That's emphatic.
There was no ambiguity there really before, but the actions of what happened at Abu Dhabi has created that ambiguity. So that needs to be now cleared up in a much more specific way. And whether you do that through, you know, if within a certain percentage the incident happens within a certain percentage of the end of the race, then it has to be red flagged or whatever way you decide to tackle it. It's now got to be put in words to remove that ambiguity. I think that's really that's the most we can hope for, really.
Yeah, I would say that my preference or priority in terms of regulations from this would be a clear-cut rule for how you handle a late accident like that causes a safety car. If it was... It was completely understandable when we read in the stewards document that the evidence given by Massey was that it included this general agreement among the teams that where possible, we have a green flag finish. And we saw that, didn't we, in Baku with that, was it the two-lap sprint at the end, which at the time when it was first happening, I was thinking, this is ridiculous. I can't believe we're going again for a two-lap race. And then actually when we were getting close to the start, I was thinking, brilliant idea. Why haven't we done this before? Because this is so much better than finishing under caution. So I like that. And I like the idea of trying to ensure a racing finish where possible. But I think that you can't have that handled in an ad hoc way. So I think a regulation that says if there is a safety car in use with X number of laps remaining or within X percentage of the race distance remaining, then it becomes a red flag situation. Because what that does is, yes, you do have a situation still where, like in Abu Dhabi, the race leader, in this case Lewis, can be winning by a comfortable margin. And then the guy in second, in this case Max, gets a second chance and a last chance to really go for it. At least you eradicate, in theory, the unfairness of guy in second is able to eliminate that gap and also change to fresh tyres while the guy in front is completely vulnerable on an old used set. Now, obviously, within the red flag restart situation, there is the issue that has been raised before about being able to change tyres under that. But I think if you were able to change to a fresh set of the same compound or something like that, I don't think that's a problem. So I would like to see that rule that said that guarantees if you're chasing a green flag finish, you have a fair and clear way of doing that. And I think X number of laps, X percentage of the race left, red flag, full restart. I think that's the fairest way to do it.
Yeah, and you do need to have a formalised process because, for example, you made the Baku comparison. The difference in Baku was that the Verstappen crash, when his tyre failed, he was on the straight, there was debris everywhere. That was absolutely a red flag. It had to be. The Latifi crash didn't require a red flag, and that's the bar. It may have been pragmatic to have stopped the race when Latifi crashed to ensure that finish, but it actually wouldn't have been the correct decision by the way things are meant to be done. So you do need this formalisation to say if there is the red flag or if there is a safety car, if there is a situation requiring the deployment of a full safety car in the last X laps, it's a red flag and a restart, and then you can tackle all the things about tyres and fuel, so on and so forth, however you want. But it needs to be formalised, because then this has always been about what the rules say and people's understanding of what the rules say, rather than what kind of could or should have been done if rules were a bit different. So the solution to this problem is in the way the rules are written and tightened up.
Just one thing I wanted to clarify on what you said there, because I agree that I don't think it would have been the correct decision to red flag it in the circumstances. Do you think this is a good opportunity for the FIA to clarify what the requirement for a red flag is, because in Jeddah, we had the red flag because Massey said that they needed to check for barrier repairs, but I don't think barrier repairs were actually needed. So in that situation, it was also technically the incorrect decision to red flag it because there actually wasn't any barrier repairs required. In Abu Dhabi, my guess is that actually from the nature of the impact and what you could see very clearly, it was obvious that there weren't any barrier repairs required. Therefore, you didn't need a red flag to check it. So I do appreciate that there is a key difference there. But if you see what I mean, the fundamental outcome isn't the same. No barrier repairs were required during that red flag, but you needed it in Jeddah to check because the worry that was that something had happened. So I wonder if this is also a good opportunity just for the FIA to clarify a few things, because while I massively disagreed with that statement that suggested we'd all just misunderstood exactly what happened, I do think there are one or two things within it that would be helpful for fans and everybody to understand things a little bit easier. So I just wonder if there's a little bit of a clarification exercise that the FIA can tag onto this with other sort of tangential stuff. Like we've talked about stuff that like the team bosses talking to the race director over the radio. That's not something that's a regulatory matter, is it? But it's something that is presumably going to be decided between them. It'll be something that is agreed upon. It'll be a technical thing, whether or not they actually have access to that radio channel. It would just be useful for all of these things to be settled clearly, even if they don't have a regulatory element.
Yeah, there's a few things there that can be done. I'm not sure you can have an absolute set of parameters on red flags, but anything you can do to make it clearer and to make it more understandable is worth doing. Although you wouldn't want to back yourself into a corner where you force a red flag when you know it's not necessary because it ticks all the boxes, shall we say. I think the radio traffic thing is important. It's one of the few sensible things John Tott said about it at the end of last year, was that perhaps they've been too permissive. And I think he's absolutely right there. The behaviour of Toto Wolff and Christian Horner over the radio was not very good. I don't think either of them perhaps would. Well, Wolff has kind of admitted that they went a bit too far, and that does need to be clamped down upon, because the last thing you need when you're a race director and trying to sort things out is have people shrieking at you for no particular reason. So that definitely needs to be got under control. So there's quite a long list of areas that can be looked into, and it, like we say, it touches on so many different elements. Well, Mark, let's get back to Lewis Hamilton. We have heard nothing from him since Abu Dhabi. We talked about the retirement suggestions. Obviously, Toto Wolff was the one who originated these, because he said in December Hamilton was disillusioned and he didn't guarantee that Hamilton would be coming back. So that shows that Mercedes want that idea out there. Given he's got a contract to the end of 2023, do you think this is really a possibility, or is it all just part of the game that Mercedes and Hamilton are playing?
Hamilton raised it actually in the post-race interview with Jensen, didn't he? When Jensen said, I know you'll be going to be coming back stronger and, you know, going out to get that championship, which you've just lost, to get it back. And he said, oh, we'll see about that. And then moved on to something else. So it's not only Toto saying it. We can't really know, can we? We can only make a judgment call from the outside. It looks ostensibly like he's making a point that he wants to highlight his question marks about the FIA's impartiality or fallibility, in which case you'd expect him to come back, once certain things have been met. But what if it's not that? We don't know whether or not he truly is totally disenchanted. If he feels it's not a dice, then why would he want to take part? That might actually be where he's coming from, a purely sort of internal viewpoint with no thought of how it's been perceived or by the outside world, and no desire to get involved with whatever the changes might be, just pure disgust and unable to summon the motivation to take part because of that. So if that's the case, and I repeat, we've no idea whether it is or it's not, then no, he might well decide to walk away. So it's impossible to make a call on it, really. Personally, I guess he will be back, but only he knows.
I guess the big question is, if it is all part of a political game, and I think that's a big part of it, because I think Hamilton is the big weapon that Mercedes has got, because people have said that Mercedes could threaten to pull out, but I don't think that works, because this team's only one third owned by Mercedes. So if you're going to pull that threat, then the FIA will say, well, the team's a commercial entity owned by several parties. They're not going to pull out because that's their business. That would just be killing their business. So that's not a great threat, but the Hamilton threat's a good one. Hamilton could have retired at the end of last season in normal circumstances, but were he to retire in anger and disillusionment of the way F1's run, that's a very, very different thing. And so that's a threat that I think carries, that holds water. So if I had to guess, and this is completely me speculating and guessing, I don't know what Lewis Hamilton thinks. I would imagine perhaps in the immediate aftermath, there would have been a period where he just said, oh, I don't want anything to do with this. But we've all had times where we thought we don't want anything any more to do with this, and because things have gone wrong and you kind of get through that, don't you? But it'd be interesting if it's actually a question of he ideally wants to continue, but the value of a threat of him walking away, or an implied threat, if you want to put it that way, is the willingness to go through with it. So he might be sat there thinking, I'll continue if I'm satisfied with this. And he'll probably have spoken to Toto Wolff about how they're going to play this and use the leverage that Hamilton's got, given he's such a massive global star. So that'll be part of it. But he may well just be sat there thinking, well, I don't really want to have to walk away. I'd like to continue. But if I'm not satisfied, I'm willing to do it. And that's what makes the Hamilton leverage so potent, if that's the case. But he may still be thinking about it. So very interesting to know where he's really at with this whole thing.
I agree that it's that Mercedes element and being able to keep pressure on the FIA in some way. I believe that is definitely a factor. And I also agree with what you've both said, that we obviously can't speak for Lewis, so we can't say anything with certainty. But I think the fact that his issue in the days after Abu Dhabi was so clearly directed at the FIA, it's not like he went into hiding and has just been a complete social recluse since then. I know he hasn't said anything publicly, but we know he obviously went and was knighted in the days afterwards. He was at the Mercedes factory for Valtteri Bottas's send-off as well. I'm sure he's been doing preparation work behind the scenes, and we've just not seen it. So it's the FIA that he's snubbed, and it's not giving F1 any extra attention that he has done. So it's very clear to me where his issue is directed. I don't think this is him being a sore loser. I think it's something that he has genuinely been hurt by. This is obviously just my opinion. But it's worth remembering, you know, when Wolff spoke in December, he was talking in very, very strong terms. He said that he doesn't think that it's possible for Hamilton to get over what happened as a driver. And Wolff said that his responsibility was to do the utmost he could to help Hamilton overcome his imminent feelings after the race in order for him to return strong with a love of the sport and trust the decision-making of the sport. So Hamilton may well continue, but I think a big part of it will come down to whether he has faith in the system around him, because whether Hamilton should continue or not is absolutely not our place to say. If he feels it's a fair playing field, hopefully he would carry on. But if his faith has been irreversibly shaken, then it's sort of like what Mark was saying. What he might not want to, and he certainly shouldn't feel obligated to. The only other thing I would say on it is, with what I mentioned that he has, I don't think he's being a sore loser. I think his actions have been interpreted by some as that of a sore loser. He's had inevitable criticism. He's had advice from all of Twitter's fictional, hypothetical elite sports people who say that he should just accept what happened and move on or come back stronger. But I think that underestimates the severity of what happened in Abu Dhabi. And I think it also misidentifies who has the responsibility to resolve this. It's not down to Hamilton to just say, yeah, okay, fine, is what it is. I'll crack on. Don't worry, guys. It's not down to him to turn the other cheek. You know, it's not his responsibility to move on from this. It's for the FIA to come out and do the right things and restore faith in what is clearly a questionable system at the moment, whether it's a team or a driver. Look how many drivers after Abu Dhabi said they either didn't agree with what happened or they were confused by how it was handled. So I think it's completely legitimate if Lewis feels the way it seems like he feels, I think that is completely legitimate. And if he is considering not coming back, I don't think that is him throwing his toys out the pram. I think it's an understandable reaction to what will feel like, to him, a horrific injustice.
What do they do if he walks?
Yeah, well, that would be problematic, to say the least. It's not there's not many top-team F1 drivers sat idle, is there? Last time they lost a driver, unexpectedly, when Nico Rosberg, then his mic dropped retirement at the end of 2016, they had to spend £10 million to get Valtteri Bottas out of Williams.
Yeah, and he was already sort of an associated Mercedes driver. They've already made that move with George. So, it's not obvious, is it? There's the low maintenance easy way would be just be to slot the existing Mercedes Formula E driver Nyck de Vries in there, but a rookie in a top seat, I don't know. I don't think so. So do you take an experienced out of contract guy like Hülkenberg, something like that? Or do you try and get somebody with a contract and buy them out of that, you know, with an opposing team? Ocon suggests himself, doesn't he? But it's a very, very difficult one to solve, really, if that does become the case.
Well, if I was in Toto Wolff's position and Lewis Hamilton would say, right, I'm done, then you would have to see if you can get any absolute top driver. So you think, well, can you get your Max Verstappen, Charles Leclerc, Lando Norris? Probably not. They're not going to be very likely. So you'd then think, well, Valtteri Bottas is the logical option because he knows the team. Slot him back in. But I also think that'd be quite hard to do because you'd want to do that for a year. And Valtteri Bottas, if Mercedes were going to come calling, would say, no, I want several years to even consider doing it, even if Alfa were willing to sell him back to the team. So it does put them in a very awkward position.
I suggested Fernando Alonso because obviously we had this, not debate, but we all had a little think about how we might want to handle it for a piece on the Races website. And I suggested Alonso primarily because I don't think it's going to happen. So I was perhaps being a little bit sort of, I don't know the best way to put it. I was perhaps
flipping.
Yeah, maybe a little bit because I just don't know if Fernando is realistically on any kind of Mercedes. Absolutely no way are we ever having him list. I don't know if that is the case.
If Mercedes lost Hamilton and they could get Fernando Alonso, I think they'd absolutely take him. They'd have to.
I just think he'll obviously be on, I assume, a contract for 22 with Alpine with an option on someone's side for 23. But I just wouldn't put it past Fernando to have something in his contract that gives him a get out if one of two or three teams comes calling, you know? So go for it. He would be top of my list to check out because I don't think he's as impossible to get as a Verstappen or a Leclerc. And I think he's the best option of those that have probably less, less ironclad or less lucrative contracts. He's someone that I think you could put in, and with his experience and his class, realistically expect him to do something special in 1 year. And let's face it, a one-year deal for Mercedes is worth 2, 3, 4, 5, 10-year deal with Alpine, isn't it? So at least Mercedes has a team boss.
Well, exactly. Yeah. We'll get onto that in a bit. But one thing you have to remember, though, Scott, in that Alonso scenario, we should say these are very hypothetical. It's at the moment, it's a little bit of fun. Although, if my scenario where Hamilton might walk away to make a point is a serious one, then I'm sure Mercedes will have a contingency plan in place. If Alonso were to suddenly end up in a Mercedes, it would absolutely guarantee that Alpine would have the best car in 2022 and Esteban Ocon would win the world championship, wouldn't it? It's just the way things work when Fernando Alonso's involved with his timing. So that would be an interesting impact. But yeah, a difficult scenario. And clearly Mercedes won't want that to happen, but they've got a good enough relationship, Toto Wolff and Lewis Hamilton, to play this the way they think they need to do it. And it just puts extra pressure and stresses the stakes that are here when it comes to the FIA analysis and the resulting changes. These things need to be taken seriously by the FIA, and I think the FIA and F1 itself, as in F1 the organisation, need to be wary of the risk of this potentially happening.
I just think the Alonso Mercedes thing, there would probably be a little bit of corporate resistance going back to 2007, and the Mercedes share of the 100 million fine was 40 million. And I think corporate level in Germany, there might be a bit of resistance to an Alonso association.
Yeah, so that's sort of what I was hinting at, but I really wasn't sure. I wasn't entirely confident I had remembered that correctly. And second, I really wasn't sure if I was comfortable saying it. So thank you, Mark.
Okay, well, you're off the hook.
Well, it's great, isn't it? It's because it's the even though Mercedes is only one third of the ownership, I'm sure they'll have various things in the deal that gives them right of veto and these sorts of things. So an interesting scenario. But I think what we can see from the potential alternatives for Mercedes, should Hamilton not be there, it's not a situation they really want to be in. So it's not good for F1, FIA or Mercedes for that eventuality to arise. Could be quite good for George Russell, though. That would probably be the main beneficiary, given he's now preparing for his first full season with Mercedes. Well, Scott, before we end the podcast, there has been some other news in the F1 world that you alluded to, which is Alpine Executive Director Marcin Budkowski leaving his position with immediate effect. Not unusual for there to be leadership changes at that team. Given he was a de facto team principal, that means it's looking for its fourth team boss since 2016. So what do we know about what's going on at Enstone?
Well, they've said very little officially. It's the end of a stint that was a couple of months short of 4 years, I think. He was, even though he was only there for whatever it would have been, so 3 full seasons, he was still comfortably the most experienced of an immature leadership team. And I mean immature just in terms of how long it's been around rather than their respective personalities or whatever, anything like that. Because as executive director, he was alongside Davide Brivio as racing director, and then Laurent Rossi was obviously Alpine's CEO. And this never looked like a sustainable long-term structure to me. It always looked like something that was weirdly cobbled together in the aftermath of Cyril Abitbol's exit, which was almost exactly a year ago now. So maybe this is the beginning of the end of that kind of period of nonsense, for lack of a better word. Or maybe it's the start of an all-new cycle of this team putting someone in charge and then binning them off 2 or 3 years later. So we've seen so much transition from this team on all sides. Obviously, since Rossi's come in as CEO, Remy Taffan, the longtime engine chief, left last summer. We've had various shakeups on the aero side, and we've had this weird three-person leadership team in place for 1 year, and it hasn't survived the first winter. So I think it's clear that this team is one that's still desperately trying to find the best way forward for the organisation. And it is a bit worrying. I guess the only glimmer of hope is that I think the longer last year went on, the more Rossi did seem to be quite clued up on the fact that the team needed changes. I spoke to him at length in November, and he talked about the fact that it had been difficult to get that three-person leadership team to work properly. He talked about the fact that the team was a bit too conservative in its mentality on the engine and the chassis side in terms of development. And it was clear that there were lots of changes made in Budkowski's tenure that hadn't actually reaped any kind of short-term gains, really. I didn't see any evidence that the various aero demons that have dogged that team for a few years now were really being ended. So I think I'm not really surprised. I think the only surprise really is that given the amount of rumours around Brivio's future and being linked with a move back to MotoGP, that Budkowski's gone before Brivio's gone. That might be the only, and I don't mean that flippantly, like it did seem like Brivio was heading for the exit door. Maybe he still is, but ultimately, Budkowski, if the team seemed to have been underperforming, Rossi told me in November last year that if he felt the team was falling short of where it needed to be on the roadmap that he set out, he would change the structure. And it seems Budkowski is the first victim of that, assuming, of course, that it's Rossi's decision that Budkowski's gone, not Budkowski's decision to walk out the door. Who knows? But he was obviously the de facto team boss. And I think, as you discovered, Ed, styled himself as the team principal as well. So it is a major loss for Alpine.
Yeah, he liked to reference the fact that because every team does have to have a team principal license, as it's called. So even if there isn't someone whose job title is formally team principal, there is somebody who has that underlying status, and that was what Budkowski had. It's an interesting one at Alpine because there are problems there. There have been a lot of process changes and communication changes in recent times. There's a bit of a difference of opinion, I think, there. I think, from what I understand, Budkowski felt the team wasn't good at adapting to these changes, but there's some feelings on the shop floor that some of these changes were not the right ones and they were causing problems in terms of getting things done, and that sometimes you can take steps out of a process to streamline it, but those steps exist for a reason and actually can have a net negative. So, yeah, interesting to see what that changes at Alpine. But certainly, Mark, we spoke on the last podcast about Omar Safnauer leaving Aston Martin. He'd been linked to an Alpine move. He's a very elegant replacement, isn't he, for Budkowski, given his track record?
Yeah, he would fit straight in. And if we're to believe the rumours that were circulating, probably back in August sometime, the deal's already done. So, yeah, he's very experienced. He's very capable. He's got a good grounding. He's both engineering and team principal background, and would be a very safe pair of hands. And I would expect him to be there in the team principal role next year.
Well, of course, we have to remember that these things can be quite complicated. Safnauer said late last year that he had a long-term deal with Aston Martin, and that was the case, but he didn't say at what end of a long-term deal he was at. I understand that probably his contract ended at the end of 2021, so that made him available. But then when you have F1 contracts, it's not just your contract ends and you're free. There's often non-compete clauses and that kind of thing that stop you immediately working for another team. So there'll probably been some stuff going on behind the scenes, which explains why he had to do his unconvincing denials. But I think Safnauer would be a very, very good piece of recruitment from Alpine and would just be the logical choice there. But it's clear there's things at Alpine that aren't quite right. There's lots of good ingredients there. There's lots of good people. They've at times kind of made good progress, but it's the sort of progress is always one step forward, one step back with them, which is why they've been bouncing around F1's midfield for quite a few years now. So it is a big deal for Alpine to get this decision right and to make sure that Rossi structures things correctly and that this team actually fulfills its potential, because it's a works team. It needs to be at the front. And with the cost cap coming in, the Concorde agreement changing the way the money's divided to make it a little bit more equitable, Alpine is kind of out of excuses now, isn't it? Certainly out of excuses on Rossi's timeline, which is to be fighting and getting consistent podiums and always at the front in 2024.
Yeah, I think this is now a big test of Rossi's capability as CEO to actually steer the team overall and get the right structure in place. He came in as part of what I said was a compromise solution to a Bitterball's exit. Exactly what part he played in that, I just don't know the extent of. But all I can say is that I felt that what he was identifying as the year went on last year did seem consistent with some of the underlying issues we'd seen at Alpine. So I think if there is any kind of optimism for fans of the team or people who want to see that team stop underperforming and finally become worth the value of its individual parts or greater than some of its parts, at the moment I think it's less than that. I do think Rossi, he at least sounds more convincing than he did at the start of the year in terms of whether he could be the right person to lead this. He wanted to get to the end of the season before committing to any changes. But he said that he said that by waiting until the end of the year, he'd have a full view of where he needed to add muscles to the team. And I wonder if he has decided that that is in Enstone senior management. But you're right that it is absolutely crucial, because Rossi's stepping in temporarily and taking charge of the team management while the replacement for Budkowski is either identified or finalised and installed. He did seem to realise last year that the team's leadership was lacking. So now defining a better structure is absolutely key to make sure that Renault's Works F1 programme stops under-delivering. But if he doesn't get this right, I think Alpine will be at risk of being undermined by a managerial merry-go-round.
Well, we still don't know what the future holds for the latest person to fall off that particular merry-go-round, but given his two decades in F1 with teams like Alpine, Ferrari and Mercedes, doubtless Budkowski will be of interest to some other organisations. What we do know is he's definitely not going to Aston Martin, as was rumoured, with former head of BMW Motorsport Mike Krack announced as Safnauer's successor as team principal. So what can you tell us about him, Scott?
Well, I won't dwell too long on his CV, because that's obviously quite easy for people to look up. What matters most for Aston Martin is what this person is going to be like as a team boss. And I actually get the feeling that Krack could be a really shrewd appointment, almost in the vein of McLaren signing Andreas Seidel. And because they come from outside F1 and they both come from major German manufacturers, it's going to be super easy for comparisons to be made between these two. It's inevitable. And this could be considered Exhibit A. But it isn't just a case of seeing all recruits from high-level programs outside F1 as the same. The competency of these individuals is what matters. you know, Seidel's been an excellent addition at McLaren because he's very capable. He's got a skill set well suited to running an F1 team, and McLaren has a structure that allows him to thrive. He's not just been a great appointment because he worked at Porsche before. So by the same logic, Crack's not going to be a great Aston Martin team principal just because of the surface level similarity of F1 team hires chief from a massive German manufacturer. What's so encouraging for Aston Martin is that those who have worked with Crack give a really clear impression of a person who has already made the transition from being an immensely capable race engineer to someone who thrives in a leadership role. I've already heard very, very positive testimony from people who have worked with him from a driver's side and also from a team management side as well. He's been described as calm, studious, straightforward. He appears to pass the character test with flying colours. It's quite important that he's had this long BMW stint and even that shorter time at Porsche, but mainly the last few years at BMW, which have given him first-hand experience of being part of an important, challenging program from an engineering perspective and a management one. And that's very important because it's put him at the heart of major decision-making. It's put him at the forefront of driver matters in Formula E and GT racing. He really does have a massive blend of experience and expertise. Martin Whitmarsh called him exactly the right kind of dynamic and modern team principal that Aston Martin's going to need. And there is every reason to believe that. He has extensive experience as a race engineer. He's got his own background in karting as a driver at a decent level. So he understands and respects the human and technical needs within a team. As long as it goes well in terms of him being able to run the team the way he wants to, and that means minimal interference from a chairman like Lawrence Stroll, who has such grand ambitions and wants everything done yesterday, he could absolutely be the right man for the job. If Aston Martin handled this correctly, I think they might have played a blinder here, because there's a genuine sense that this man might tick the very rare boxes of being technically savvy, being well-versed in the demands of senior management positions in motorsport, and also being a good man manager who leads by example.
Yeah, on paper, it looks like a very shrewd appointment from Aston Martin. So let's see how he gets on in the coming season for that very upwardly mobile team. Well, thanks very much to Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell for your insight. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen for all the latest from the world of F1, as there's always plenty to read there. If you'd like something else to listen to, check out our sister podcasts, including Bring Back V10s, with the latest episode of that delving into the 2001 Spanish Grand Prix and Mika Häkkinen's last lap heartbreak. And if video's your thing, head to our YouTube channel. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.